So this is the second and third of the fourth foundations that I want to share about. And these are incredibly interesting. Sometimes called mindfulness of feelings and mindfulness of mind. But I want to put it together, partly because of the brevity of time, but also they really complement each other. They help, it's a way to understand what they're about because they're very resonant with each other, these two, second and third. And what's amazing about them is that they're really easy to miss. We're talking about cultivating aspects of our experience to be mindful of. And, you know, body's really obvious. And we'll be talking about the last one, mind objects, which encompasses a whole arena of thinking, is really obvious. It's in our face. These two can slide right by, and we won't even notice. But they're really important, which is why it's so profound that the Buddha pointed them out. And they're very important. But if we, the brilliance of one aspect of the brilliance of his teachings, if we didn't point them out, we might never cultivate mindfulness of them because we wouldn't even realize that they're there. So I'll share what I'm talking about. So, and this isn't just a sort of a theoretical thing, it's really important for our practice. I mean, it's come up in the groups, you know, especially Vedanas, which is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and states of mind, which is what we're going to be talking about. And they're very important to our practice and often underlie what we're struggling with in ways that are hard to see. So the second foundation, Vedanas in the Pali language, it describes how we respond to contact through any of the sense doors. And from a Buddhist point of view, there's six sense doors: taste, hearing, touch, sight, and mind. Whoops, one more, and mind. I forgot the other one. Smell and mind. So six sense doors. And it's how we viscerally respond to those. Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neutral? Just that simple thing. It sounds so simple that it's almost like, really? But it's incredibly amazing the more you look at it. And it's often translated, it's hard to translate. It's often translated as feelings, which confuses people and they think it's emotions, but it's not. And since sometimes translated as sensations, but that doesn't exactly work either. So Vedanas is one of those places where the Pali word actually works the best. It's like dukkha works best for instead of suffering or unsatisfactoriness, because those don't really work either. In this case, Vedanas is the best, but it's this very primal, instant, reflexive response of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Do we like something? Do we dislike it? And it comes up again. I'm not going to get down the weeds here too much, but maybe I'll touch on it at the end, in terms of what's called the five skandhas, the five aspects that we make up our sense of self from. And the first is body, the second is Vedanas, and the third is perception. So before we even perceive something, we react to it. And that's amazing, because that makes the world go round. But we're so used to this, we don't even notice. We're so used to navigating our lives this way, we don't even notice we're doing it. And it drives our decisions, it drives our sense of well-being in incredible ways. I mean, what would it be like, just hypothetically, if we didn't have any of those kind of preferences, if pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral didn't
Oh,
mean anything to us,
absolutely.
if we were just present without caring? Just present, no matter how, whether it was pleasant or not. That's amazing. How freeing would that be? How much are we in the thrall of those responses otherwise? So that's why the Buddha pointed that out, named this as a second foundation, because it's so primal. And if you think of, you know, what goes on in the world. I mean, this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral just that makes worse start because of that, because some leader thought this was unpleasant and started a war to make it stop being unpleasant. It's amazing how much. And in personal relationships and the kinds of decisions people make, whether they're stupid or not, you know, they often do dumb things because it seems really, really pleasant, or because it seems really, really unpleasant, and they kind of do compulsive things and then causes all kinds of wreckage in relationships. But just to be able to witness that, to be mindful of it without acting on it, is pretty profound. And think about, you know, like the last time, I mean, look at our consumer culture. You know, we're online, I don't know, Amazon or something, all kind of different shoes or drill bits or whatever our thing is, but we're scanning across all these options. Oh, that one looks good, that one doesn't look good, kind of maneuvering through that. You know, our whole consumer culture is cleverly designed to get us to discern pleasant and unpleasant and buy the pleasant. And so we've gotten so used to that in a way that I don't think other cultures were. It was hyped up anyway. It's amped up here in 2025. And we do this so, so unconsciously. I mean, we just go, you know, or walking down the street and who's cool and who's not and what's pretty and what's not and where do I want to go and what do I want to avoid. And it's just like an insect wing. It's so fast. We don't even know we're doing it. We don't even know we're doing it, which is the point. We do it unconsciously. So the more we can pull that in, it's huge. I mean, certainly it's a fact with people. You know, I'm susceptible to that, who I think is, you know, more attractive, less attractive, more interesting, less interesting, more cool, less cool. I do all of that stuff. It's embarrassing. And I've been a teeny bit about it around the Dalai Lama. I think I told this story, but maybe I will. It was 1993. He was here in Seattle. It was a very incredible couple-day visit. Taught amazing teaching on Chenrezig, Yidam of compassion in Tibetan Buddhism. Anyway, so the Dharma community formed a security group. And I mean, at that point, in a sense, he was lower profile. They had two Seattle police, and he had his own one bodyguard, and then there was about two or three of us from the Dharma community, sort of, we had a little security team, so he's backstage, I can't remember what that place is called, but this, it was about to do, like, Patty Murray's, like, on stage to this thousands of people over near Seattle Center. It was a big deal. We're down in the grotty corners down there. He's about to go on stage. She's introducing him. And a little cluster of us, five people and three Dharma bums. And this one of us three, in my way of, you know, incredibly subjective, judgmental, weird way of thinking, he was kind of a dweeb and he wasn't cool. And I was thinking, I just was sort of, I don't know, it's not cool. I mean, he wasn't even thinking that. I just unpleasant kind of, you know, backed away a little bit. And he had, this was years ago, so he had this kind of watch where you stuck a thing on your finger and it did your pulse or something, and it was like a really cool technology. And he showed this to Dalai Lama. Oh my God, you're... And the Dalai Lama completely engaged with him and just poured love into this guy, who was a dweeby guy that most people didn't pour love into. And I just watched him melt. This guy just melted. And it was like, oh my God, it was so humbling. I was just, you know, what an idiot I. And watching this unconditional love pouring into this being where, from the Dalai Lama's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, did not matter. It was compassion, period. It was incredible to watch. So I learned a big lesson there, you know, about how much I judge and how much I micro-judge and choose, and how prevalent it is. And to be mindful of it when it happens. It's not a good thing, bad thing. To be mindful of it when it's happening is the point. And you can see why this vagueness is right after body, because we make contact through the sense doors and then we register pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral very viscerally often, and then we go from there. But it's right after body. It's very visceral. And check it out sometime, like, you know, I mean, I'm married and my wife is wonderful. And we're human beings. And sometimes, you know, we've been together 30 years. We've changed and shifted and aren't always on the same page about what priorities in life are, about everything. Sometimes we have, you know, vigorous exchanges or something vigorous happens. And to see the unpleasant, that's what's incredible. I can see, oh, unpleasant. I can see it in me. And then I can be mindful of that and not react. It's huge. Because if I just do unpleasant and just don't want it to happen, then people do all kinds of weird stuff with people when they're having a heated moment, right? They try to make it stop. They push it back at the other person. They're the problem. But it's actually unpleasant. It's pretty cool. It's pretty powerful. Now, I'm going to jump to the third one, kind of see how third foundational mindfulness, which is mind, citta, C-I-T-T-A, but in particular, it's referring to states of mind, like what is an underlying attitude of mind that we're walking through life with that we might not even realize we are. That's the tricky, but this is subtler. The first one has to do with contact, contact, result of contact. This one has to do just within our own sphere, not contact at all, just how we are. It's really hard to recognize. And in both these cases, we can walk around and not even realize we're doing this. That's the point. That's why it's so amazing that these are brought up to be mindful of, because most folks, and you think about how people are, they're trucking along, reacting to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, not even realizing they are. And the second one is like states of mind. Like it's like a fish. A fish is not aware it's in water. And oftentimes we're in a state of mind and we don't know we're in it. Sometimes we can see that with other people. You may know someone, oh, they're characteristically gloomy, or they're characteristically kind of seeing the cup half full, or kind of grumpy all the time. Do they think they are? Probably not. They think I'm just being me, you know? But we can see that. What do they see about us, right? Ooh, that's embarrassing. You know, you could get really close to someone and they'll point that out, what our characteristic patterns are that we're not aware of. So it's a big deal. And what if those people that we find so difficult could be aware of their patterns? And rather than acting them out, see them clearly? Or what if we could be aware of our patterns? And wouldn't our partners and family members be happy if we could see those clearly and not act them out? So these are really significant and so subtle and so hard to see. When I first was studying the four foundations, and they're short too in the text, they're short. I mean, it's just like half a page, each one. It's not six, it's like each one has one refrain. And there's not much explanation. But nonetheless, they're the second and third foundations. And I kind of didn't get it. It's like, what's this about? But then more over time, as I worked with them and brought them into my practice, it became clearer and clearer why the Dalai Lama, as an awakened being, so clearly saw these of the four foundations of mindfulness and pointed us in that direction. And the conditions that he named, you know, they starts off with the three: greed, hatred, and delusion are the prevalent qualities that he's talking about. And some of you may notice the three poisons. They're called the three poisons. They're right at the center of the great wheel of life, driving it all, is greed, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons. And those are like the most active, most vibrant qualities of mind that we may be walking around with. But then there's other ones in the suttas mentioned, being distracted or narrow, you know, just kind of sub aspects of that. And there's a sort of a parallel, because greed means wanting, hatred means pushing away, ignorance means not noticing, and it's kind of parallel to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. There's a parallel there. You know, we want things that are pleasant. We want to get away from things that are unpleasant. We kind of space out on things that are neutral. So these two have a parallel component in terms of this core three poisons. But I found this in my own practice and during difficult periods. It's been really important. I've been through, you know, a couple of traumatic periods and, you know, going through a time where I was gloomy and didn't realize I was exactly. And then at a certain point, I could see it as a quality that was simply existing right now. And to be able to be mindful of it, then it wasn't me anymore. It was simply a quality happening right now. And it was a tone of mind that I had, and I could, you know, but maybe I popped out of it for a few minutes, but oh, my goodness, I'm not in that tone of mind. I guess that's not inherently me because I just popped out of it. Or connecting with someone with a very different tone of mind and really having a connection and realizing, oh, wait a minute, there's a whole other way to see life. I forgot that I'm in this tone of mind, and then, you know, just not adhering to it anymore, which is kind of what happens with mindfulness in the first place. We become mindful of something, some aspect, some bodily aspect, and we just don't identify with it. We don't think it's me. Because that's part of what drives the whole catastrophe, is that people have qualities and they think it's me. Then they glom onto it, they concretize around it, push against the other, who then becomes the enemy, or hate themselves, all that stuff. So these are really subtle, but really, really worth looking at. So it's just amazing that both of these have an aspect of mind. You know, first was body. Both of these, the last three of the four foundations are in different ways about mind, about our inner tapestry. And these two, in a subtle way, are about mind. You know, how we, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, that's internal. And certainly states of mind is internal. So that's so powerful in terms of, because that is, you know, I mean, we're mostly not talking about our bodies in our groups or in our spiritual lives. We're talking about our mind heart and how it is and how we are with ourselves and how we are in our journey and all that. So these last three foundations are about all different aspects of that. And these two are really, really worth exploring in yourselves and see if you can identify them. You almost got to like tease them out to be able to be mindful of them. But kind of, you know, just when, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, it's like just when something is unpleasant to go, oh, unpleasant, unpleasant, even noting it. I do that sometimes. I usually use it noting, unpleasant, unpleasant. Just see that quality of unpleasant or pleasant and just be able to just see it while it's happening. Oh, then you don't have to do anything about it. I found that's really helpful with, you know, any kind of, not that I don't have much of these, but any kind of a leanings towards acquisitiveness or something, you know, and just see that little time. We had to make a big health decision. We had a running joke that it cost as much as a new Audi. And so, you know, it's like, damn, not that, the new Audi I didn't get, which I didn't want really, but I didn't want it at all. But still this like little, I could see this little tug. I was like, my God, look at that. That's so funny. This little pleasant Audi. I didn't want an Audi. Honestly, I don't. But this little thing that would come up and being able to look at that and just slip the clutch on it. It was real, real interesting seeing how it happens. So I just found these very useful. And they help us see how we're navigating, you know, external phenomena, internal phenomena, contact with people, deep relationships, the whole thing. It's very powerful to not get pulled around, to be able to respond instead of reacting. This is right at the core of that. Because if we can really be mindful of that, then no longer becomes an issue, and then we can hear what's needed in a deeper way and not react to what our pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral is, or not, worse yet, maybe act out in a way because of some underlying quality of mind we don't even see. And, you know, the second noble truth, that which makes us suffer, grasping and aversion. So this cuts right into that area. It really unlocks suffering. So that's kind of what I wanted to share there. We got a few minutes. Any thoughts about that? Yes, sir. Bear with me.
So the Vedanas come before perceptions.
Correct.
So could you address, if it applies, could you address the, if there are any wholesome or unwholesome quality about Vedanas and then perceptions? Because can you not have, is it wholesome to not have Vedanas? Not have pleasant or unpleasant or neutral?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Vedanas arise. They just,
okay, so
they arise
just
from contact. Yeah, we don't have
right.
any choice maybe, but
okay. All right.
But nonetheless, so, thoughts in one way, I mean, it's a great question area you're exploring, and there is a huge amount of choosing that we make around wholesome and unwholesome thoughts. You know, we can choose. To some degree, well, thoughts arise, and to some degree, we can choose. It's kind of like dance, you know, part of the
right.
dance of spirituality is navigating through right. those two vectors happening simultaneously.
So we have no choice about what Vedanas that arise.
Right.
And so the wholesome and unwholesomeness comes in what perceptions we have, and we can to some extent have
well,
control
perceptions,
over perceptions.
I mean, perceptions kind of happens too, but it's more a matter in the whole area of choices, you know, is in the arena of karma, but do we choose wholesome mind states, choose wholesome thoughts toward others, you know, the whole arena of the Brahma Viharas as a whole, that's like choosing, cultivating loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and upekkha. You know, there's a lot of choosing there, cultivating there, so things arise and we can choose and kind of out of that. But the mindfulness part is, you know, it's just like thoughts arise, which we'll be talking about on the fourth foundation. That's part of the almost like hilarious aspect about being a human is thoughts. In fact, we, you know, Gil Franzel often uses the word thoughting instead of thinking because it's not me thinking. They're just thoughts, so like our thoughting is happening. But having said that, then we can start choosing which ones we're going to cultivate and you know, string out on, dupapancha on, which ones we're just going to, okay, just let it blow by and cultivate the wholesome. So, kind of in there, does that work? Sweet, good questions. And this person over here to your right has a hand up and almost in line with the camera. This is so perfect.
How does...
Yeah, you're good.
How does consciousness play into this?
Say more, please.
How does consciousness?
I mean, I heard your question, but can you say more what you mean?
Yeah, well, I think I get confused as to what consciousness is.
Yes.
And like, you know, in the body, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness, I feel like the first four, I have a sense of, but then consciousness, I usually interpret as awareness.
Right.
But I don't know if that's it.
Yeah, no, this is an incredibly subtle area that, you know, I can quickly get over my pay grade. But in terms of the five skandhas you're referring to, the last one is and I can't think of the Pali word, but it's not chitta, it's conscious of. It's like a function of consciousness of a phenomena, like a, cause it's, excuse me, the sense doors, sixth sense door, is conscious of a phenomena. So it's a function of contact, conscious of, whereas, as you're sort of suggesting, this is where we get into problems with English and a little bit of cross-tradition stuff. This particular sense of consciousness and mindfulness and nature of mind and Rigpa and Buddha nature and all that stuff can get really complicated and crisscross, and it's hard to track. But in terms of the particular thing you're referring to, I think it's an effective way to think of it as conscious of in terms of the six sense doors. And that actually is helpful because then it's a function. Like we're conscious of something, just the same way. It's like a sense door, you know, we see a color, we see light, and there's a tool that makes it do it, there's a processing, and there's an external phenomenon. It's the same with that form of consciousness. But there's this broader sense of what awareness is that can even be debated among different schools. And so I'm not quite, you know, I mean, I could, and again, over my, you know, someday when I'm a Buddha, let's talk about it. But it's certainly different in Mahayana tradition and, you know, Dzogchen tradition. It's held very differently. But it's kind of one of those, like someone over here was saying, kind of point in that direction and see what you see too. I'm happy to, anyway, I'm talking too much. What are you asking?
Well, is, okay, if I'm understanding.
Yes.
So there's impact in the body, impact in the sense store.
Right.
And then there's the feeling that arises from that.
That's a vedana.
As well as
right.
Then, and the perception of what that is and the mental formation.
Got it.
And the consciousness is the awareness of that.
So you're talking now, yes, okay, so now you're talking about, she's talking about the five skandhas and the way we put together a sense of self. And yeah, it's such a tricky one because it's often said that within the five skandhas, it's somewhat intuitive to understand how these, the first four aren't us. The fifth one is the hardest one to see through because, like, wait, I'm conscious. How could that not be me? And to see it as a function. And it is, if I'm correct, is a different Pali word than the sixth sense door, which is what I was talking about a second ago. I'm not quite sure. But it's often seen as the subtlest one to not posit self in, is the fifth of the skandhas. And that's what you're, I think that's what you're referring to there. Yep. Yeah, it's real interesting. Yeah, and but it's a wonderful edge to keep working on. Because it is, it does stretch our sense of concretization and self-identification to the max. Because we do posit I there. It's really hard not to. But you can start to see flickers of, well, actually, there's no I there. There's just awareness happening. There's just awareness happening. Yeah.
Thank you.
You bet. Anybody online? Let's see, where are we at now? 1028. 228. Okay. Okay, folks. Well, let's sit. And if anyone needs a bio break, just, you know, quietly do that. But otherwise, let's just sit for 30 minutes. This is where we're swapping the original schedule. And then after that, we will have walking and group four, which will be online. But it's a good time to sit because we've been throwing around, exploring lots of aspects, somewhat mental. And especially in light of the second and third foundations, you might do a little bit of analytical meditation and bring that up in your minds, ways in which you've encountered pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Maybe think of a moment that you've encountered it. And if you could be mindful of that phenomena of pleasant or unpleasant and how that might change your relationship to the situation, just, you know, explore it briefly in your practice as if it was happening now, or maybe it is. And the same with states of mind. You know, I know a few people here have articulated some difficult things are going through. So it's a time to take a look at your quality of mind, whether it's anxiety or worry or fear, and how much are we walking in that? How much has it become us as if we're inherently that way? when actually it's a set of conditions right now. That'll change. One way or another, it's going to change. We don't have to be that way. And we can convince ourselves, we can forget and come to the conclusion that that's how we are, always. But it's never true. There's always conditions. So to bring mindfulness to that some quality of mind that seems just pervasive right now, like we'll never see the light at the end of that tunnel, and see how perhaps it's a set of conditions right now, which will change. And that we don't have to be in a certain mind state that we've been in. And the more we can bring mindfulness to either of these two at this point, it opens the possibility for change, because people ossify. You know, sometimes people get bitter around some circumstance that they've never been able to see through. They just conclude, that's me. It just becomes a hard stone in their hearts, and they never let themselves change. Even though the conditions change, I didn't even know they changed, they become a bitter person. Like, why are you bitter? Just who I am. So the more we can bring mindfulness to that, even when it's really rough, it brings a fluidity to who we are and the possibility of emerging in a different way, and in a possibility of holding even the most difficult feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, or qualities of mind, more lightly, even in the middle of it. Even in the middle of it.